We're ready to proceed with our pre-launch briefing at this time for the Apollo 15 mission. Before getting ahead, let me cover a few logistics for your planning purposes. The news center here will be open all night, and there is a release downstairs on the departure times for bus transportation and so forth. You all should know our office number here is 783-7781, and there will be people on duty throughout the night to inform you of the status. We are now, I believe, in our built-in hold of 9 hours and 34 minutes. The countdown will be resumed at 11:34 p.m. This evening, aiming toward our planned T-0 and liftoff at 9:34 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow morning. We have one pool position left in the Launch Control Center. If anybody desires to participate in that pool, please check with Mrs. Hunt downstairs and give her your name. This entails one person in the control center and a second person at the press site who will type down the information, turn it over to the NASA people at the press site. It's a pool operation, and we will release it to all the news media at the site. Anybody interested in that, it would require two people to do the job. Check downstairs following this briefing. We're now ready to proceed, and gentlemen, as far as the cameras are concerned, it's quite hot up here. And we would appreciate it if it's a certain time through the conference these hot lights could be brought down. We would appreciate the cooperation. I think the gentlemen up here are feeling it already. And now I'd like to introduce the participants to you. From your left, we have Colonel Kenneth J. Mask of United States Air Force, who is Director of Department of Defense Manned Spaceflight Support. Next, we have Mr. Richard Smith, and Dick is the Saturn Program Manager from the Marshall Space Flight Center. Mr. Walter Caprian, who is Director of Launch Operations here at the Kennedy Space Center. Dr. Rocco Petrone, who is the Apollo Program Director, NASA Headquarters. Next, we have Mr. Chet Lee, who is the Apollo Mission Director, NASA Headquarters. Next, we have General James McDivitt, who is the Apollo Spacecraft Program Manager, NASA Manned Spacecraft Center. Mr. Donald K. Slayton, who is Director of Flight Crew Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. Charles Berry, Director of Medical Research and Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center. And finally, Mr. Osro Covington, who is Director of Networks for the Goddard Space Flight Center. Standing by in Houston and also ready to answer questions here during the conference are Mr. Sig Schoberg, who is Director of Flight Operations, and Mr. Jerry Griffin, who is the Flight Director for Apollo 15. Dr. Petrone.
Thank you, Jerry. As you all know, it was 2 years ago this past week, we made our first landing on the moon with Apollo 11. Shortly after that landing, in the ensuing weeks, we made certain decisions to expand the exploration capability of the Apollo system. As you know, this involved the development of new gear, things like the rover, the experiments that had to be selected to go into the scientific instrument module, and generally extend our capability to explore on the moon. Apollo 15, now 2 years later, represents the first of the J mission series, which has this added capability and a goal of increasing our ability to explore the moon. During the past 2 years, there's been a very high level of effort to qual our equipment, rerun our engine tests, take care of all those things that, in effect, had to go through a Delta requalification because of the extra effort we're going to demand of it, as well as that new gear flying for the first time. The last 6 months, I've seen most of that gear flow into here at KSC and reached a point today, as was just mentioned, that we're at T-minus 9 hours in Holden, ready to step off on what is our largest mission to date in terms of exploration. All the hardware, in terms of its tests and functioning, is go at this time, and we're ready to take that step as of now. With that, I'd like to ask Chet Lee to give us a few comments on the things yet to do, and the weather, the outlook for tomorrow. Okay.
Well, I think, as you all are aware, we are in the hold, and what we're trying to do at this point is to outwit the weather. As you know, the scheduled move of the MSS was at about noon today, and this has been delayed to be no earlier than 6 p.m. this evening. Now, the preparations for the move take about 2 hours, so Cappy's people would have to start about 4 if we wanted to move at 6. We just had a briefing from Ernie Ammon just a few minutes, half an hour or so ago, and the prediction is that we have a weather alert starting about 2 o'clock out at the pad area, and it should clear about 4 p.m. this afternoon. Now, of course, Cappy's people are prepared to follow that in real time, and if necessary, we can delay that a little while longer and still be in a good posture to give us the protection from lightning that has given us so much concern the past few weeks. Tomorrow is predicted to be similar to what it was this morning. And with a 9:34 liftoff, we should be in good shape. Our window closes at 12:11. We could have some clouds moving in. These things change, as you well know, but we still should be okay for the entire window. With regard to the readiness of the other people, the DOD forces are on station, are deployed, are ready. The manned space flight network is ready. Everything is ready to proceed. Picking up the count this evening at 11:34. As you well know, we will have another one-hour hold at 5:04 in the morning with liftoff at 9:34. So with that, we're ready to go.
Okay, for a status on the crew, we now want to ask Deke Slayton to make a few comments on the crew status at this time.
Well, crew's ready to fly. I have been for the last 3 days. This morning we did a little work on the geologic traverses. Right now they're out getting a little sunshine, I hope, if the sun is still shining. And they'll come back in and spend a little more time on traverse number 3 late this afternoon, eat about 6:30, go to bed around 8, and that's the size of it.
Thank you, Dick. And for the overall medical status, we now have a report from Dr. Berry.
Well, I guess you all know that we had the 5-day exam and everything was fine at that time. Since then, the crew's been checked on a daily basis and we have no medical problems at the present time. Our flight crew health stabilization program in the pre-flight period has been going very well this time. There are some illnesses in the Cape area, as I'm sure some of you may have become personally aware of, in that there's some of the common GI upset type things that are going around at a fairly good rate in the local area. And we have had these involve a couple of our individuals who are not directly associated with the crew. One is that we've had some questions about is Jim Irwin's wife, Mary Irwin, and she's had one of these gastric upsets and is doing very fine and has had no contact with the crew whatsoever. And we have another one and one of the other astronauts who's here, Phil Chapman, who has the same type event. And again, there's been no contact that we have any problem about. And we thought we ought to just let you know that the flight crew health stabilization program really is working.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Berry. We're now ready for questions here in the Cape. Just wait for the microphone and please identify yourself if you would. Mr. McFeely, right here in the front row.
McFeely, Associated Press, I guess it'd be to Chet Lee. What is the latest time you can move that service structure away from the rocket and still go on time?
Well, I think Cappy is probably in a better position to answer that.
Well, we can probably delay the move, if necessary, to something in the order of 10 or 11 o'clock tonight. But we hope very much to be able to move a little earlier than that.
Can you go as late as 11?
Yes, we can start rolling as late as 11 and still make T0 on time.
That's starting to roll, not prep.
I want you to start walking back up. This gentleman back up there with his hand up, please.
Jim Sorrell, KBFM News, Los Angeles. Has the Soyuz 11 accident caused any or affected any changes in wearing of environmental suits during the mission?
Yes, it has. I'd like to have Colonel McDivitt answer that question.
After the
Soyuz accident occurred, we went back and reviewed all of the procedures and the equipment that we have in the spacecraft and other associated equipment that might in any way be affected by the same type of thing without really knowing what that thing was. It was obviously a loss of pressure somehow. And in evaluating each one of the events from liftoff to insertion to the orbital thing, translunar injection, the lunar trip, the thing, operations around the moon, back towards the Earth, and then the reentry, we found one case where we felt that we could improve the safety of the crew. And this was at the time that we jettisoned the lunar module. At that time, we sort of blow a ring off the end of the command module, and we felt that by leaving the pressure suits on at that period of time, blowing the lemma and its associated ring on the command module off, that we could improve the crew safety. So we are changing the crew procedures for that particular period of time. It also turns out that we might just have changed the procedures anyway because there's a limited amount of time between the time you can get out of the limb and into the command module and when you have to jettison the limb. And to take the suits off and stow them is a long, complicated thing. So it helped the crew procedure timeline and it also increased their safety, so it's a very good thing to do.
Right up there.
Mark Kramer, CBS News. Dr. Barry, do you have any comments on reports a few days ago from Moscow, unofficial and unconfirmed reports, that one of the Soyuz cosmonauts was alive but in bad condition upon landing?
Well, I've heard those. All I can say is I've heard that same report, and I don't believe a word of it. I think you're going to hear that kind of story probably. That kind of thing will continue until we have a total exchange of the data, and we look forward to being able to do that in October. We hope that we're able to totally exchange that information and put that sort of conjecture to bed. But I certainly do not believe that in any form. I think we have good evidence that's not so.
This question for Walter Caprian. Exactly what protection do you have against bad weather, lightning specifically, by keeping the MSS where it is?
Well, first of all, we're maintaining the configuration that we've been in for the last several weeks. Every lightning strike that we have had, we have been in the same configuration that we are in at the present time and are holding until the bad weather passes through later today. And the big thing, of course, is to have the mobile service structure protect the space vehicle partially by surrounding it to some extent. As you know, we have silos around the spacecraft area, and then we also have a grounding system between the mobile launcher and the mobile service structure, which we do not want to destroy until we're quite confident that we're not going to get bad weather, because we've seen some strikes, we've known how we react to them in this particular configuration. If we were to move the service structure back early, then we'd have an unknown configuration.
John Wilford.
John Wilford, New York Times. Jim, why is it at this particular event, the jettison of the limb, that you feel that there might be a problem? Vibrations or something?
No, I didn't say that there might be a problem. It's just that we've evaluated every phase of the mission, and we find that there is some increase in safety. Anytime that the crew has their suit on, it increases their protection against the loss of cabin pressure, but it also has so many, many detrimental effects throughout the mission, so we don't wear the pressure suit throughout the whole time. When you jettison the limb, you actually fire an explosive device which cuts the front end of the tunnel on the command module off. This puts a big structural load on the tunnel. Now, it's more than adequate, and we've demonstrated it many, many times in qualification tests. But it is a structural event, and we try to protect against any structural event like that. We've never have had any trouble in the past with it. We don't expect any trouble in the future, but it adds that ninth or tenth place of safety that we're always looking for.
Mary, right here.
Bite it.
Seriously.
Sir, would you help the lady?
Rocco, what would you, in your opinion, keeping in mind that this site is not as well known as the previous mission sites, how would you estimate how much more dangerous this mission is than any previous ones and the chances of them, you know, completing a landing or having to abort because of the rough terrain?
Well, I think we know the site quite adequately, which is the important thing. I think every landing on the moon has that element of risk and danger, regardless of what site. The question of craters and boulders, we have assessed a nearby area. We are really landing in a mare type, because it is a mare. Fortunately, with two nice features near it that we want to get to, the rail and the front. We're very confident with the work that has been done to pull out of the photographs we have from the orbiter. We're very confident that we'll have a good spot to touch down. But any landing is risky. Jim, would you care to comment on that? Because you did most of the work with your people there at Houston looking at those maps, and we did pore over them many, many months.
You see, there are a lot of times when you can take and transpose knowledge from one part of the moon to another part, especially when they're adjacent. And we have some very good high-resolution photography of an area just adjacent to the place we're going to land. And we can extrapolate that data over to the place where we are going to land because it's exactly the same kind of terrain. Now, we had never been able to predict where a crater this size is going to be because you just can't see those things. But by this extrapolation of the data, the high-resolution data that we have, and by in trying to enhance the medium resolution, we're quite sure that that's a very good landing site. But like Rocco says, you never really know what's going to be there until you get down on the moon. It doesn't make any difference how good the pictures are because they only show you so much.
Right back here.
Two quick questions. One to our DOD man on the flotation collars. Would you tell us, expand upon what you know about the slash collars at Eglin? And one for Jim. Would you expand a bit for us on the decision to re-enter shirt sleeves and why that, in your trade-offs, and why that's probably safer for our missions?
Colonel Massey?
Well, the flotation collars had single puncture wounds on the end of the cases. They were covered, they were not opened, and it obviously had something that was driven through the end into the flotation collar. That's about all we know, and they're being repaired, and they have been replaced. Well, can't really say. The OSI is looking at it right now.
We evaluated each phase of the mission because the problem with the Soyuz was not necessarily a reentry problem. The reentry happened to occur, but they do other things. Their spacecraft is made up of three modules, front module, a middle module, and a back module. And they reenter in the middle module. So when they reentered, they had to separate the forward and the back one. So we were looking at two specific kinds of things, the separations, which led us to look at the LEM problem, any penetrations we might have in the cabin. Now, during reentry, it's a very spectacular kind of an event. There's fire and changing in G's and all these things. But as far as the spacecraft is concerned, it's a fairly benign environment. The G level that the spacecraft gets to is only 8 or 10, and it's doesn't come on suddenly. It's just a gradual increase in G, and the spacecraft is qualified for 78 G's for landing. So 6 or 8 or 10 G's is nothing compared to the qualification level. The temperatures that the structure gets to is very low. So all those things led us to believe that the reentry is a safe thing in shirt sleeves. Now, why? But wearing a suit, of course, increases your probability of survival if you have a hole in it. So what's the disadvantage? Well, the disadvantage is when you hit the water, that is something that you just can't describe analytically and do a good engineering study on to the exact detail that you'd like to. And it's much more of a traumatic event as far as the spacecraft is concerned than the gradual increase in acceleration as you reenter. Now, if you land on the water and you're wearing an 80-pound pressure suit that's very, very bulky and difficult to maneuver around in and weighs a lot and is very difficult to swim in, you find that you're less safe by wearing a pressure suit in the water egress and emergency situation there than you would be if you were in your bathing suit. Now, we don't wear bathing suits to take care of that problem, but you weigh the increase in safety during reentry against the decrease in safety by wearing that heavy pressure suit at water impact, and you find that you're decreasing your safety by wearing your pressure suit during reentry. Now, that doesn't mean that we wouldn't wear the pressure suit during reentry. If we had something that led us to believe that we would increase our safety more during reentry by doing that, that would offset the decrease in safety at landing wearing the suit. And it's really that trade-off. The mission is made up of many, many events. You don't ever want to look at one single short period of time because you may find that you haven't evaluated everything else and you're really decreasing your probability of doing something. And that's the whole reason.
We don't have time to change.
Oh, yeah. Chet mentioned that we don't have time to come in pressurize and then take off the suits while we're hanging on the parachutes. There's only a few minutes before we hit the water. So you can't have them both. You have one or the other.
Jim, assuming we did have a leak like the Soyuz presumably had, would we have, what kind of monitoring system would we have so we would know it in time?
Okay.
And a question for Chuck afterwards.
All right. Well, when we separate things like the limb, we check to make sure that the hatch is sealed. We look at the pressure. We evacuate on the other side of that hatch. So we put that into a vacuum. And then we measure the pressure in that other side. If it doesn't stay at a vacuum, it means that we have a leak in the tunnel. Then we could take, since we haven't separated, we could take the hatch off and fool around with it and put it back on and do that until we got it fixed. Now, if we find that we could never fix it, we'd have our pressure suits on and we wouldn't go ahead and jettison the limb until we were all buttoned up in the suits. Now, during reentry, after you separate the service module, there's the cabin pressure gauge and there's the O2 flow indicator and those kinds of things that would warn about that. We don't try to do any traumatic event to the spacecraft unless we're suited. And it just might be worthwhile to point out that during the times like docking and the launch and other critical times during the flight, the crew is suited. And we have a schedule that says they're suited at this time, they're not suited at this time, they're suited at this time throughout the whole flight. And we always have them wear the suits at those critical times. But to answer your question specifically, we have a flow meter, O2 flow meter, which has a gauge, and it also has a light that indicates that the flow gets too high. We have a cabin pressure gauge that also has a light on it. We also have telemetry to the ground, and we can set lights to work off that telemetry on the ground.
Thank you. And Chuck, you said that Jim Irvin's wife hasn't had any contact with him, and even though she has a GI, so when was her latest visit?
I don't think Dr. Berry described the medical case.
No, I mean, you said you...
I didn't do that. You did that.
You said there was no contact, and yet the wife's got...
Not in the last 21 days,
they,
she hasn't.
They really have not. That's been a decision that the crew's made, and they have not.
Mr. O'Toole?
Since the 4th of July.
It was the 5th, when it started on the 5th of July. 5th of July. Morning of the 5th of July.
It's a question for Mr. Caprian. Why can't they load fuel? I think I understand, but why can't they load fuel tonight if the mobile service support structure is there?
You say, why can't we load fuel?
You can't load your cryogenics.
There's no technical reason why we cannot. The reason is there's a hazard to people, and we have a requirement to have the mobile service structure back a certain distance so that should something occur, we're beyond what we call the blast area. That's the reason. We can, as far as the technical operation is concerned, keep the mobile service structure around the vehicle and load the complete bird. There's no technical restriction to that.
Back up behind Mr. Tool. We'll be up in the front row here. Back just a moment.
For Jim McDivitt, what's the situation on suiting at the time of separation of the command and service modules?
When the service module separates from the command module, the crew is unsuited.
Shirt sleeves.
Shirt sleeves.
Over there.
Wanda Wells, WCFL News. This question perhaps may be old hat, but would one of you gentlemen for me run down the various things that you hope to accomplish from this mission?
Didn't hear that.
The lady is asking for a rundown on the various achievements we hope to accomplish on this mission. Well, quite a bit is outlined in the press kit, but
it would just take much too long, I think, comment. For all the members of the press really to go through. It is a press kit that is available, and there are really many, many objectives that I really think would take too long to give it a fair answer, Jack, but I'd be glad to try if you think so.
If you want to make perhaps in a general manner, Rock.
Well, look at we got like four primes. We say, one, we're going to do an exploration of the Hadley Apennine site, which has, as you know, a rill and a front, which we think will give us more insight into the evolution of the surface of the moon. We are going to do experiments from orbit for the first time, which will give us data 360 degrees around the moon. And then knowing this one spot where we're at on the ground well, we'll be able to use that as a baseline to interpret where we fly over. We'll cover about 16% of the lunar surface with our orbital experiments. We are going to deploy an ALSAT, that's another remote control station. With that, we complete a network of a seismograph. We complete a network with a laser reflector. For the first time, we'll do an experiment with a drill looking for heat flow. These are the major things, and one really could not do justice to the total mission unless we wanted to spend many, many more minutes on it. But generally, those are the three, four items, the top of the heap, without really describing why and what and how.
Just as a comment, the flight plan is about that thick, and to really talk about that intelligently here in the detail you need, just would be impossible. We'd be here until after launch time tomorrow.
Thank you. John Lennon, right over here.
Has anyone kept a tally of the lightning strikes in, on, and around the pad area? And if so, what's the number at this point?
Well, I guess I can answer that one. The mobile launcher since the 14th of June has been struck 11 times. The first day on the 14th of June, it was struck three times. One time on the 15th. We had a strike on the 25th of June. On the 2nd of July, we had five strikes, and we had a strike on the 19th of July. The maximum intensity strike that we had occurred on the 14th of June. One of those three strikes, we recorded 98,000 amperes of energy. As far as around, I can personally attest that on the 15th of June, I was in the firing room about 8 o'clock in the evening, and it was raining lightning. You just look out and see rain coming down, it's lightning. And I think the Patrick Station recorded something like between 200 and 300 strikes in a two-hour period in the general area.
Over here. Bear with me. You're the only hand up here, and there's about four or five. I'm trying to save the energy of the man with the mic. We'll get to you, sir.
George Engel, ABC News. For Dr. Barry and Deke Slayton, is there any correlation between the reports of the weakened conditions of the Soyuz 11 cosmonauts and the change in Stu Ruse's physical condition after the lunar orbital mission of Apollo 14? And have you made any corrections in exercise programs to offset any of this?
Well, you say, is there any connection between these two? Obviously, any person who is exposed to the spaceflight environment has certain physiologic adaptive things that happen to him involving his heart and blood vessels and his muscles and skeleton that we've talked about in some great detail before. Now, I think it's important to emphasize that what was observed on the Apollo 14 flight in Stu Ruse as an individual who had been weightless the entire flight was not to any degree that was greater than anything we had seen in a previous flight. And that's important to understand, too. I think it's gotten, perhaps there's some misunderstanding in that regard because there is a difference between the two individuals who were on the lunar surface who did not have the same changes to the degree that we had seen on previous flights. And that's the significant thing there, not the degree that the individual who was weightless had. He was no greater than what we had seen on previous flights. He followed the pattern that we expected to see, as a matter of fact. So there is some relationship, obviously. We have not made any significant change or feel that there is any real need to make a significant change there. And Deke might want to say something particularly about the exercise program.
Well, we're doing essentially nothing different on 15 except programming 2 half-hour periods a day for the CMP. We had one before. And of course, the problem is when he's up there in orbit around the moon by himself, he's very, very busy. And the tendency in 14 in particular was to forget to exercise because there's so many other interesting things to do. So we're just going to try to force it a little more on this flight.
Mark, we've got quite a... I'm going to ask you to wait since you've already had a question, if you don't mind. There's a number of people asking the question.
For Chuck Berry, is there any consideration in 16 or 17, or had there been any on 15, of using that Russian-type elastic exercise suit?
No, Mark, there is no consideration of using that. We do not foresee any difficulty where this would really help us in the time duration of flight that we have. Now, that suit of the same type that has been used by the Russians, we have used in bed rest studies, and as a matter of fact, we can say in bed rest studies up through 9 months that it will not preclude the cardiovascular deconditioning nor the loss of calcium.
Okay, let's come up here in the front row.
Good Bob Gordon, WBBQ News, Augusta, Georgia. Anyone who can answer this question. Have you ever pinned down the problem with the latches on the docking probe? And if so, has there been any changes since Apollo 14?
Well, we've worked very diligently trying to find exactly what was wrong with the Apollo 14 probe, and it's worked very well on the Earth. And we haven't found a single thing that was wrong with it. But there were a few funny things. There were some scratches in a little hole at the end of the probe. We've taken some steps now to make sure that we don't get any contamination down in that hole, just in case that could have caused it. There's a pin that runs through there that shears off when we jettison the tower. That pin was not restrained before. It in no way had anything to do with the Apollo 14 incident, but we retained that pin just so that it can't possibly get out. We went back and we looked at the operation of the very complicated device, which is on the interior of this big tube that actually operates this probe. And while we didn't find anything wrong with the Apollo 14 probe, we did find some indication from some of the other probes that we may have had some finding, or could have finding in this mechanism. And we have made some changes in there. We've